Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.
Ezra, this is my new mission in life, which is to try and fix the mechanics of our government so it can actually deliver to us.
Hello and welcome to The Ezra Klein Show on the Vox Media Podcast Network. I first had Andrew Yang on the podcast back in August of 2018, which feels like forever ago. But I've known Andrew a lot longer. I knew him back when he ran something called Venture for America, which was trying to build on the Teach for America model to push young graduates of top schools to go do startups and small businesses in communities that had not been part of the huge wealth inequality in America, right? Go start things in the middle of the country. That was a super fascinating guy then. And then when he ran for president, I thought it was interesting, did not expect all that much to come of it. But he did, a really remarkable job. He pushed ideas out into the mainstream that weren't there. And he modeled a kind of political decency. And oftentimes in the debate, in a way I appreciated, a quizzicalness. You could see him sitting there thinking, like, this is how we do it. This is what it looks like. That I always thought was valuable and refreshing. When Andrew was on the podcast last time, we debated a bunch about AI and what it would do to the economy and whether or not a UBI would be the right solution. A universal basic income would be the right solution, even if AI did upend the economy. But a couple years later, we are living through a very different kind of economic upheaval. Andrew Yang is no longer a presidential candidate, though he did speak at the DNC and made some interesting points there that we talk about. He's now part of a group, founded a group called Humanity Forward, which is trying to pilot universal basic income on a small scale. As he reveals in this show, he is thinking about or talking with the Biden folks about taking a role if there's a Biden administration. He's got his own podcast called Yang Speaks. Everybody's got a podcast now. But I wanted to have him on right now because we've been going through this series about mobilizing the economy. This podcast is part of that four-part series, the final part. Unbox, the series is called The Great Rebuild, and it's made possible here and there by Omidyar Network, which is a social impact venture that works to reimagine critical systems and the ideas that govern them and build more inclusive and equitable societies. My part of it, the part I wanted to do here, was about how do we remobilize the economy post-COVID? And so we've looked at the Green New Deal. We've looked at thinking about how to remobilize the economies in general, going all the way back to the work of John Maynard Keynes. We've talked about what to do for children. And the question I had for Andrew is something like UBI and economic mobilization, is putting money into the hands of people, which to the extent Congress seems comfortable doing anything, it tends to be that, is that the right way to mobilize the economy? But we also talk about a lot of other things in here, from the right stance towards technology to the importance of making government function differently and better to the kinds of values that drove Andrew on the campaign. This ended up being a super fun conversation. You can find all the podcasts in the series, plus pieces from the highlight, including a special issue coming in September, at Vox.com/the-great-rebuild. Again, Vox.com/the-great-rebuild. But here, with great pleasure, is my podcast with Andrew Yang. Andrew Yang, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks, Ezra. It's great to be here.
So in the time since you've been here, you became a famous Democratic presidential candidate, went from long shot to one of the last six or seven standing in the debates. How has your life changed?
Well, my life has not changed as much as one might think, Ezra, because of COVID. I have been in with a family similar to you and Annie and little guy. Is it little guy, right?
Little guy. 18 little months. Little guy.
I had that right. Good. So
little shrieking guy.
Yes, they do tend to shriek a lot. My first was a real shrieker, and he remains so to this day. And that was a while ago for me. my older is seven, so he's a still shrieky 7 year old. But my life has been similar to many other Americans, where I've been in my house a whole lot, been Zooming a whole lot. And so I certainly feel grateful that I have the ability to contribute and help in a greater fashion than I would have months ago. And super indebted to everyone who supported my campaign for that. And
No. You're giving me the political answer here. Don't give me that. Like, you represent something for people now, and you didn't before. People put hopes in you, and you hold those, and you, like, how does that feel? You've become something you weren't before. It's a lot to hold on your shoulders.
Wow, Ezra, you sound like you're speaking from experience. Do you hold a lot of people's hopes and dreams over there? You want to?
Listen, I got no gang, man.
I do genuinely feel grateful every day to the Yang Gang. And I do feel this responsibility to use whatever platform or power I have to help people. So we've been putting money into people's hands, because everyone knows Andrew Yang is all about giving money to people. So we've distributed $8 million plus in direct economic relief in increments of between $250 to $1,000. In some cases, up to $3,000, like $1,000 a month over 3 months. So that's been a real focus. I've been helping down ballot candidates. This is all getting political again, Ezra. I apologize. I genuinely have felt a ton of responsibility to do as much good as I can, because there's so much suffering and pain and anguish right now in the country. And I feel like I'm one of the relatively few people who might be able to help.
We're going to talk a lot about UBI in this conversation, as people might expect, and giving people money and how that might remobilize America. But I want to talk about something from your presidential campaign that I was reflecting on. When you began the run, and you and I have known each other a long time, way before you ran for president, but when you began the run, I understood it as a campaign based on ideas that you thought should be in the national conversation and weren't. And then what surprised me about the campaign, the way it played out, was how much you emphasized an approach to politics, a way of talking to each other, a way of talking about each other that felt different. And I'd like to hear your thinking there, how your thinking evolved during the campaign on political persuasion and what interpersonal values were missing in politics that you felt able and felt some resonance from bringing into the race.
Ezra, I have to say, it was a real surprise to me, where when I showed up on the scene, I thought I would be received and perceived as to the left of Bernie, where I thought that people would say, even Bernie didn't go so far as to say, give everyone money, like Bernie, stop short of that, and that I was somehow going to be the most progressive seeming candidate. And I used to joke that I was going to be like Bernie, but younger and more Asian. But that's not how I was received at all. I was received actually as this realignment type figure, where I was talking in terms that other candidates were not. And what's funny is, for me, it was just the way I communicate. So people listening to this can take that for what it is. But I was arguing from facts and figures, and my concern about the fact that we'd eliminated 5 million manufacturing jobs, 4 million due to automation, primarily in the swing states, that decided the 2016 election. And just by my talking the way I talk, it ended up being a different approach to politics that some people got excited about. So that was something I did not anticipate. And I did end up learning from it and adapting to it. And I learned that there are a lot of people that do want us to approach politics in a different way than we have been over the last number of years.
So this is a weird thing to tell somebody, but I don't think that's actually what it was for you. And maybe I'm wrong on this, really? but as somebody who also built some career on being good at communicating in facts and figures, and also in the aesthetic of communicating in facts and figures, right? I didn't have a math pin, but Wonk Blog and charts. And, you know, there's both the reality of it, which you try to do in a real substantive way, and also the signal of it. There are other people who did that too. I mean, Elizabeth Warren is a very facts and figures oriented candidate. What seemed to me to resonate around you with folks that I did not expect was that you really never seemed to dislike anybody on the campaign trail. You didn't dislike people who didn't agree with you. You didn't dislike people who insulted you. You didn't dislike the people you were running against. You spoke fondly and with a lot of empathy towards people on the other side. The way you framed your policies had that dimension. You're talking about the Bernie Sanders and imagining yourself to the left of him. But one way people experience politics isn't just ideological. It's also on this axis of confrontationalness. And you had a pretty distinctive like left policy agenda. But on the confrontational axis, you were way down, right? You would talk to people Democrats would rarely talk to, go on programs they would rarely go on. And even now on Twitter, I think you very self-consciously cultivate a very nice persona in a very unnice space. And I'd like to hear a bit about how you think about that, because whether it was all authentic, I think there's at least some recognition that it has power now. And given that it's a pretty basic thing, I think it probably had more power than you would have expected, or certainly than I would have expected.
Wow, Ezra, I hadn't thought of it in those terms. But I mean, you've known me for a while, so you know that the nice thing is a complete facade that I'm actually naturally very bitter. Now, it's the case that I like most Americans, and that I think that there have been massive problems that have been built up over decades and decades. And you wrote a book on polarization and why we're polarized. And I feel like people have gotten driven into different corners and pitted against each other in a way that's unproductive. I naturally don't get angry at people that disagree with me. I kind of expect a degree of political asynchrony because, you know, it's like not like someone's going to believe everything you believe. And one of the things that I did find running for president was that the media would often try and goad me into conflict. It would be like, this person said this, what do you think about that? And the dynamic was supposed to foment an expression of outrage. And then I would say something that seemed to me to be like the natural reaction. But I just think that the outrage cycle is very, very negative. And I think a lot of Americans, including me, are very tired of it. But I can genuinely say it wasn't really a strategy on my part. And it's not a strategy now, except insofar as when I'm putting out a message, I just find it more productive for me to be positive than for me to throw a rock at somebody.
It always struck me, too, that it reflected in part the media you came up through. So I think when most Democrats run for president, they think about getting coverage on, you know, MSNBC and in Democratic or liberal aligned publications, which tend to reward a more confrontational approach. And that's true also for centrist publications, right? You have a great story on your blog about being at an early Iowa event and like all the reporters are there to hear Michael Avenatti, including like the centrist reporters who just want conflict. But you came up, I mean, you're on this podcast pretty early in your campaign, but you did Joe Rogan's podcast, my friend Sam Harris. You were on like a lot of YouTube world things. And it's a very political space. And sometimes it can be even an angry space, but it's like a more mixed space. You had like a lot of fans on Reddit and 4chan. And that struck me as like informing your approach way through that those are different worlds to talk to where people have different political concerns. And it always struck me that you ended up representing a slightly less polarized media in what ended up working for you and what you then were rewarded for saying and representing in politics.
Ezra, I genuinely went where they would have me, I guess, where initially the MSNBCs and CNNs and, you know, centrist publications were not very excited to have me on, frankly. So if you were me and you were like, who wants to talk to me? Like, hey, do you want to talk to me? It's one reason I'm grateful to you, because you had me on when others were not. And so I'm grateful to you. And I've always seen you as a very, very smart, fact-driven purveyor of what you regard as truth, you know, and it's one reason I appreciate you in this conversation so much. And I did not get that vibe from some other outlets and journalists. And so, you know, it really was a necessity being the mother of invention, where I would talk to people that would have me on. And a lot of those folks were YouTubers and podcasters and folks who didn't have a cable network behind them.
Yeah, it worked. I mean, I want to get to UBI, so we won't spend all time looking retrospective of your campaign. But it did just strike me as, I thought you and Pete Buttigieg did the best job of this. And you did somewhat differently, right? I don't think Pete Buttigieg would have gone on Ben Shapiro's show and debated circumcision. Like, that wasn't his vibe. But there was a, like, Joe Biden, for his virtues, has a very old media view of politics and also doesn't do that much media. And a lot of Democrats who'd come up through the ranks for a long time, like, they saw media very much, I would call it the way it was in 2005. And now there's this burbling, fractured, and it can be very polarized, but it also can be very mixed up in a way that can be useful world out there. And that if you're, a lot of it has much more audience than people, I think, in the mainstream media recognize. You know, what some of these folks on YouTube are able to command is in the millions. It rivals the cable networks, but it doesn't have, like, the mainstream establishment respect that, say, a cable network does, and so it gets ignored. But it's no worse a way to reach people. And I think Reddit had that quality for you too. Like, you were very big on Reddit. I was just on Reddit yesterday, and you're involved, I guess, in some California data privacy initiative, and it had 23,000 upvotes just noting that you were part of it. So these are pretty different worlds. And I wonder how much you think the Democratic Party, or just traditional politicians in general, are missing them and leaving these worlds unspoken to.
This to me is something we should talk about more, Ezra, because I think the shifting media landscape is going to impact politics very dramatically, and some folks are going to be late to it. Like, you're on top of it just from that line of questioning. But if you look at the cable news audiences, you're looking at the low millions, and it tends to be like the same 2 million people over and over again. And you're talking about a massive population of, you know, tens of millions of voters. And so you hit it on the head, where if you look at the audience of some of the biggest podcasts, it goes into the millions. It is higher than the cable newscasts. And the cable newscasts drive this media narrative bubble that then gets self-reinforcing. And then everyone looks out and says, like, hey, aren't you concerned about whatever the heck we were concerned about yesterday? And meanwhile, like, they're just listening to Joe Rogan or whomever, you know, like, that they're getting a very different perspective, and they're hearing about issues that are more relevant to them than a lot of the DC oriented issues. The biggest example of that on the trail was impeachment. I don't think I got a single question about impeachment the entire time. And this was when he was actually getting impeached, you know? So there are different conversations happening, and it would be very beneficial for politicians generally, but Democrats in particular, to start trying to broaden their universe, because what you don't want to do is just end up in a world where you're just talking to each other and then wondering why no one's listening to you. And that's the danger.
And one of the things that I like about these different worlds, as somebody who, I try to spend a certain amount of my media diet in subcultures that are not my main one, because I think it's important to know how their argumentative universes work and what they consider important and unimportant. And this, to me, was always a secret of your campaign that people didn't quite realize, that politics, Washington politics, has developed a set of things that it considers like the questions of the day, the week, the month, the year. So, you know, at a certain point, it's impeachment, which is very, very, it was important. Like, I ran an impeachment podcast, and I think it's important what was happening there. But taxes, healthcare, I mean, these are real things. You might ask, like, how did this guy, Andrew Yang, get on Joe Rogan and some of these other shows? Because he doesn't allow just anybody on. That's a big show. He has a lot of options about who comes on. And there's this whole world that is very focused on AI risk and what that's going to do and how that's going to change things. And when you came up and wanted to move that up as an issue in politics, increase, like, as a political scientist would say, increase its salience in politics, there was a world of people there for that, because they were already having that conversation, but nobody in politics was. Like, politics reflected the set of issues that Washington thought was important and understood how to talk about. But it's not the only set of issues people care about. And so then there are these whole worlds that are really underserved in terms of their concerns. And like, what always struck me as an interesting bypass you took into this was like the value of your campaign to me was it elevated concerns that deserve more attention in politics than they typically get, not just solutions, but concerns. And you know that I have a different view on a lot of the AI economic risk than you do, or at least somewhat. But there's no doubt that it should be talked about. And so you went where people were talking about it. And I think there was a lot of surprise that so many people were so concerned and so engaged on this and so ready for a candidate to try to say, no, this should be one of the 10 issues we talk about. Like, let's move something else out of the frame.
Yeah, that's right, Ezra. Where if you talk to techies, they're much more concerned about AI. And as you know, the central argument of my campaign around automation than a lot of other Americans. And they were happy to talk to a political figure who was talking about something that they'd been thinking about for months or years. And one of the funny byproducts of it all was that I ended up having conversations with people that didn't feel terribly political, if you know what I mean. It was like, look, like, what's going on with AI? Like, what should we be concerned about? Like, what does that competitive landscape with China look like over time? And because of that, I ended up reaching audiences that generally did not consider themselves super political. And hopefully I did broaden the range of concerns that we should be looking at as a country. It wasn't very deliberate on my part. I mean, I just cared about what I cared about and went to folks who also cared about it. But it is a sign how both DC and the media have this relationship where there's like a set of prescribed concerns that may or may not line up with the concerns around the country.
Ezra Clanjo will be back after a short break.
Support for The Gray Area comes from Mint Mobile. Mint Mobile's whole deal is pretty simple. They sell premium wireless services totally online. And they say that by cutting the cost of retail, they can pass all those savings on to you. Switching to Mint Mobile means saying goodbye to an overpriced monthly plan or unexpected fees. You can get 3 months of premium wireless service for $15 a month. That includes unlimited talk and text, plus high-speed 5G data. You could even bring your own phone number to your new plan when you switch. To get this new customer offer and your new 3 month unlimited wireless plan for just $15 a month, you can go to mintmobile.com/gray area. That's mintmobile.com/gray area. You can cut your wireless bill to $15 a month at mintmobile.com/gray area. $45 upfront payment required, equivalent to $15 a month. New customers on first 3 month plan only. Speed slower above 40 gigabytes on unlimited plan. Additional taxes, fees, and restrictions apply. See Mint Mobile for details. Support for this podcast comes from Greenlight. If your parents wrote you a blank check when you were 10 years old, what's the one thing you would have bought? I know for me, it would have been Podcast Futures. Or maybe that yellow Ford Ranger pickup truck that the lifeguards on Baywatch used to drive on the beach. That looked like a lot of fun. I don't know why I needed it. Didn't have the money anyway. But I wanted one. Would that have been a smart, long-term financial decision? Probably not. I would have learned that lesson the hard way. But what the Greenlight card wants to do is help your kids learn those vital financial lessons the easy way. Greenlight is a debit card and money app made for families. You can send your kids instant money transfers, get real-time notifications of spending, manage chores, and automate allowance. A colleague of mine here at Vox uses the Greenlight card with his two boys, and he loves it. You can sign up for Greenlight today and get your first month free when you go to greenlight.com/gray area. That's greenlight.com/gray area to try Greenlight for free. greenlight.com/gray area.
One of the things that I think politics systematically underrates in importance and tends to be very bad at talking about is technological change just in general. How important it is, what is happening with it. We functionally live in a gerontocracy where I think Nancy Pelosi's 80, Trump is 74, Joe Biden is 77, Mitch McConnell is in the upper 70s. I think he might be 77. Like, this is not the most tech-forward leadership group you could possibly imagine. And so a lot of what is changing in technology, which is really important, I think it gets underplayed. So let's have a little bit of a conversation there. AI, how has your thinking changed on it in the past few years compared to, you know, 2 years ago or whatever it was when we talked? Do you think the landscape there has changed? Do you think there are things people should know that have happened?
A lot of the things I was concerned about have now come into full view because of the pandemic. And you know that companies that were considering investing in AI and robotic meat packers and the rest of it, and robot aisle cleaners in the grocery store, now those companies are accelerating the investments. And the example I use is that now if you get a Domino's pizza and a self-driving car, you're excited because you had less human contact, whereas before it seemed a little bit creepy. Same with the self-checkout aisle. And if you look at AI, there's this new release that now can do a lot of writing and basic summaries on a level that's indistinguishable from human journalists.
You're talking here about OpenAI's GPT-3, yeah?
Yeah, OpenAI's GPT-3.
Yeah, so if people haven't heard of this, I'm going to put in show notes. My colleague Kelsey Piper did a great piece on this, but it's surreal. Let me put it that way. What it's able to do in terms of language processing is wild.
And 2 years ago, if you'd asked me, hey, is software going to get to this point? I would have said yes. But then you could still argue over it. You know what I mean? And now 2 years later, it's here. And you can see the commercial potential of this technology. One of the reasons why I was so concerned about the impact of AI on our labor force, Ezra, is that I know how many, frankly, inefficient jobs there are in a lot of these major companies, where if you gobble up another company and you have two different systems, you might keep dozens, even hundreds of folks around just to keep the systems talking to each other. you know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of weird stuff when you get into the bowels of some of these organizations. And I knew that over time, AI could end up making a lot of those types of jobs less and less central. The arguments about human labor and AI, they tend to be non-market driven and kind of romantic. You'd be like, oh, you know, like, you can never replace a human who does what Ezra does or what Andrew does or whatnot. But, you know, a lot of our work is more replaceable than we like to think. And what's funny is if you ask Americans about this, they will actually say a majority of other people's jobs are automatable and subject to technological replacement. And then if you ask them about their own job, the vast majority will say, not my job. You know, that's just the way we're wired.
It's why I'm fleeing to the high ground of podcasting. I mean, they're going to come for the calmness way before they come for the podcasters. It's much harder for AI to have a good conversation than for it to just write up a take on the GDP report.
anyone like us, we're already at the top of the pyramid. You know what I mean? Like, if you have a podcast with a significant audience, you've already made it to a certain point. Like, and if you think about all the folks who are coming of age right now, like the younger versions of us who are graduating from college right now, it's like, you know, the winner-take-all economy applies in many spaces, including the ones that you and I occupy.
Oh, absolutely. So I have some slightly different views on how many jobs are automatable and even what the coronavirus is going to do to the desire for human contact. I think in many ways you're seeing how irreplaceable, at least parts of it are, how much people want it. But people can listen to our previous show to hear our views on that. What I do want to dig into here is something that you were hitting, where I do think it's really true, which is that we are going to see and are seeing a bunch of jobs get automated in a shock-like way because people need to find ways, at least in the near future, to do things with less human contact between human beings. And we're seeing this moment that is a very deep reminder that people don't have control over their economic fortunes, that all of a sudden a pandemic virus or something technological advance could happen in your industry that lays you off or that destroys the economy in your town. And so you really get into, I think, your argument now for UBI, which AI, coronavirus, like these things begin to almost operate as like metaphors for just a shock and what happens to people during a shock? And do you want to leave it up to Congress to argue about expanding UI benefits during a shock? So there's been a lot of movement, actually, in the Andrew Yang direction, or as I often like to think about it, the Annie Lowrey direction, towards just giving people money during this pandemic. And that's been a real policy shift. That is not how we've done things during past crises. So I'd like to hear you talk a little bit about why you think that's happened and what you think we can learn from its performance so far.
I am very happy for it to be the Annie Lowrey direction. And certainly, you know, I'm thrilled about anyone who gets on board. Doesn't matter why or what you call it. You know that there are now dozens of mayors around the country who are championing guaranteed income. Michael Tubbs, the original, but there are now dozens of folks, Keisha Lance Bottoms, Eric Garcetti, and around the country who are committed to universal basic income pilots. And the reason, Ezra, is that now it's just common sense where you look around and you see that there are tens of millions of Americans who've gotten shoved out of the labor force because we don't need as many bartenders, airline attendants, security guards, ushers, personal trainers, you name it. Like, there's so many jobs that required physical proximity that now just don't make sense. And like you said, it's not no one's fault. And so then you look around and say, how are we going to get economic resources into the hands of these millions of people? And cash relief is the only sensible solution. And $1,200 in April going out had a really positive effect on many households and on propping up our economy. But we need to make that regular, recurring, predictable. We've been living off of the first CARES Act. But then now that benefits have elapsed, you're going to see distress and disintegration pick up in many, many households and communities. And there really is no feasible way to help so many households manage this except for direct cash relief. And it's not just you, me, and Annie and Mayor Tubbs. At this point, last I saw, 76% of Americans are pro-cash relief during the pandemic, and 55% are now pro-universal basic income. So it's no longer the magical Asian man making this case. It's the majority of Americans realize it's common sense and something we need to do.
So there's a big jump between using cash transfer for relief, which is what we've seen during the pandemic. And as you say, is already Republicans already moved into a stance of opposition on it, even though the pandemic is ongoing, and moving to a basic income floor. And right in the middle of that jump is this argument that Republicans are now making on the UI, on the unemployment insurance, why they won't extend the $600, which is that if people can get paid and can support themselves in their lives without working, they won't work. And the point of American economic policy should be getting as many people to work as we can, no matter what, no matter what job they have to take. And so what is your argument to them? What is your argument to the Republicans who say, look, relief is fine, but we do not want to be paying people not to work because we want people working?
I would agree and say the last thing you want to do is tie economic relief to job status or employment status. So if you put cash into someone's hands and say, you can have this cash unless you start working, then it actually is a detriment to them going back out there as quickly as possible in some cases. I mean, most people will still just be panicking until they find a job. And so to me, this effect is overstated and overblown. But to the extent it exists, you are right now tying a lot of this cash to employment status. I would say make the cash unconditional, and then you'll have a baseline. And if you go out and get that part-time job because it's not ready to be a full-time job because the bowling alley or the retail store is not at full reopening yet, then you get to keep that money, as opposed to right now saying, well, wait a minute, if I take this job, then I stop getting benefits. So the problem right now is our existing legacy infrastructure that ties the cash relief to not working.
But I think you're underselling what's happening there a little bit. It's not just legacy infrastructure. It is, on one level, I would call it a value that people hold. On another level, I would call it a political argument people make. I think there are different ways to frame it. But there is a long-running belief in American politics that money should be tied to work. And you mentioned being to the left of Bernie Sanders. I remember in 2016, sometimes you would go to Bernie Sanders' homepage and you would get this splash, right? Like the pop-up would be, nobody should work 40 hours a week and live in poverty. which isn't nobody should live in poverty because we give them money not to live in poverty. It's that work should pay, right? The minimum wage should be higher. The EITC should be higher. And so that's not just a thing you see on the right. It's a thing you see on the left. It's a view Joe Biden largely holds. It's a view many liberals have traditionally held, that not only is it like a good thing to push people into the labor force, but also politically, people just don't like the idea of folks getting something for nothing. They don't want to see their cousin or their neighbor laying about. And so I think that's the argument, that how do you rebut that argument, the sort of more moral values argument, not just the technical argument?
I think that argument is, to one of the earlier points you made, just really, really out of date. You know, it harkens back to some 70s or 80s notion of employment where if you work for a company, they'll treat you right and give you benefits and you'll be able to live a fine middle class life. In an era when most of the jobs that have been created are gig and contract and temp jobs, and they don't have benefits in many cases. It also doesn't include caregivers and stay-at-home parents like my wife, Evelyn, who's been at home for a while, in part because one of our boys is autistic and was very, very much in need of her time. So to me, this is not an argument that, frankly, like liberals and progressives should fall for, where it's like, oh, I mean, I 100% agree with the statement that if you're working full time in the United States of America, you should not be poor. But I also think that my wife works harder than I do, you know, most every single day. And there are moms around the country who are in the same boat, and they should not be poor either. And trying to define work as this anachronistic show up to an office or factory 40 hours a week is missing the evolution of our economy that's been happening for decades.
Why a UBI rather than a negative income tax?
I'm a huge fan of a negative income tax. And if that's where it netted out, I'd be thrilled. I prefer a UBI for multiple reasons. I even think it's probably a better sell politically, but like the reasons why I prefer the UBI are that it lowers the administrative burden because you don't need to figure out how much I made last year or this year. It removes any strange shenanigans in terms of trying to report a low income. Like if you have like a couple, for example, you could be like, how about I work and you don't work, and we'll make it so you don't have any income, and then we'll make it so you get some money the following year. And it alleviates a timing of payments issue, because if your circumstances change from one year to the next, you're not likely to get your negative income tax immediately when you might need it immediately. And politically, I think it's more appealing to be able to say to everyone, look, you have intrinsic value. This is how much you get for being an American, a human being. But I would be thrilled with a negative income tax if that's where we wound up. I mean, if you alleviate and eradicate poverty, I am all for it.
Do you think the U.S. government has a spending constraint on it? Could we do a UBI and a Green New Deal and Medicare for All and just put it on the national credit card? Or do we have limited resources and we have to make choices between them?
Well, the argument I made on the trail, Ezra, which I sense you'd agree with, is that we have a revenue problem in that the biggest winners in the 21st century economy are paying zero or near zero in taxes very often. And the most prominent example is Amazon, the $1 trillion company that paid zero in federal taxes last year. And so what I said to folks is like, look, if you have Amazon paying zero in taxes, you're going to have affordability problems for sure. And that if you harness the gains from the Amazons and Apples and Netflixes of the world, then you have a lot more revenue to work with very quickly. And then if you put that money into people's hands, that money does not disappear. It ends up going right back into the local economy in the form of car repairs and daycare expenses and the occasional meal out. And those businesses all then create more opportunities and can create virtuous cycles that help end up creating jobs and human well-being. But the big thing, Ezra, I think, is that we need to stop measuring our economy in terms of these narrow economic outputs, where if you try to figure out what's good for us by what's good for the stock market, then you're lost. And so if we...
Wait. I'm going to hold you on this argument before you go into it, because I want to stay on the... I'm not measuring our economy by narrow economic outputs, by GDP right here. The question I'm asking is...
Can we afford it?
I know. Do we need to pay for things like this? And what I would say is, I know the corporate tax data on this stuff, you know, well enough to say that the list of things I just gave you, Medicare for All, UBI, and Green New Deal, you could do everything that the folks I know who want to tax corporations and rich people quite a bit more think we should do. And in most cases, I want to do those things too. And you wouldn't come near paying for this set of things. So at some point you have to, there is a question of whether or not these things are worth raising taxes for, which I often think they are, but taxes are a hard sell. And then there's a question which you will sometimes hear people associate with modern monetary theory and other things arguing, which is that maybe we don't need to raise taxes for them. Now, a lot of MMTers would say you can't do things this big without raising taxes because you'll get inflation. So that's an argument as well. But that's my question for you. Like, do we need to figure out how to pay for it? Because if we have to figure out how to pay for it, then it's going to be a, it's going to force more choices and more sequencing.
I agree with everything you just said, Ezra. And I also have seen the math. and I know the price tags on some of the things we're talking about. But one of the things I said to folks on the trail was, what is the cost of not addressing climate change? Or what would the cost of climate change be if we just let it wreak havoc and ravage our country? And then people reflect on that for a second. Most of them don't know, you know, the size of the economy pre-pandemic was $22 trillion or so. So if I throw that in there, then they say, well, climate change is going to cost us trillions of dollars and thousands of human lives if we were to do nothing. And so then you start thinking, okay, the cost of inaction is in the trillions. So then what is the benefit of our investing in climate change mitigation? Particularly if you start measuring how we're doing based upon how we are actually doing as human beings. Like if you have a group of people drinking unclean water or having their town submerged, you know, that might not show up in certain economic indicators, but it ought to. So the way I'd answer your question is to say that we should not be thinking we can just do everything under the sun in terms of putting it on the government's bottom line, but we can be much, much more aggressive than we currently are about making large-scale investments in our own future, in our infrastructure, addressing climate change, and putting universal basic income into our hands. Because in many cases, a lot of these investments will end up paying us back in both human ways and economic ways. And the argument I'd make on the trail was that if you have universal basic income in people's hands, does that improve our educational outcomes? Does that improve our health outcomes? Does that reduce the cost of incarceration? Does that improve the ability of ex-convicts, their ability to reintegrate into society? Like, there are many, many things that we spend a ton of money on right now that we could reallocate or alleviate if we invested directly in our people. And that was what a lot of people were missing oftentimes, is that the investments you and I are describing actually pay off, and in many cases pay for themselves.
So I couldn't agree more on the disastrously narrow way we think about investment, and particularly on climate change. But that actually gets to the core of the series that this podcast is part of about remobilizing the country. And on some level, we're not going to be able to do everything. And so one of the things that I think about, if it were up to me, what would happen first? I worry a lot about that long-term cost of climate change. I think people should take a look around at what coronavirus has done and then recognize that climate change could do that at much, much larger scale for much longer with an endless ratchet into worse and worse and worse outcomes. And so if you don't like this, maybe like, let's not let that happen. As we think about, or as the Joe Biden administration or any administration thinks about what to do first, there is going to be a tension between the government saying, hey, let's remobilize the economy to this purpose, say a Green New Deal and climate change, or let's get money into people's hands. Let's try to give people demand side stimulus. Let's mobilize around things like cash transfer payments. As somebody who's been in the UBI game for a long time, but also I think takes climate change pretty seriously and takes preparing for the future pretty seriously, what would you like to see happen first?
I think we should be investing in people immediately, because I'm terrified as to what's happening in households and families around the country right now, Ezra, where no, it's a stressful time for me and Evelyn and my kids. I'm seeing my kids suffer somewhat for the fact they just don't see other kids. And I feel like we're very, very fortunate on the high side. If you look at the mental health statistics right now, they're staggering in terms of depression, use of the crisis text line. Like, there's just a lot of pain right now. And so the first thing we have to do is just make sure people can put food on the table and keep a roof over their head and not have mass evictions and the rest of it. And so there are the ways, structural ways that you can do that by, for example, continuing an eviction moratorium. But to me, that those are temporary measures in a way that putting cash into people's hands would be more direct. Obviously, in my case, it would be in perpetuity. And I think you would see a lot of folks have their heads up very, very quickly. I also think that having people be able to meet their basic needs is an accelerant for addressing climate change. Because if you have everyone in a position where they have to do whatever the cheapest thing is, and they have no other choice, and then you ask them to change their habits in some way or care about climate change, even, it's actually much more difficult. The climate change investment, and it's related to this human well-being question, we just need to create jobs in any way we can. I mean, the labor market is in such a disastrous condition. And so if you can tie that to infrastructure, solar panels, Green New Deal, like things that help us modernize, then I am all for it. But you shouldn't stop there. Like you should say, look, if there's anything we can do to get people into some kind of productive mindset or environment, then we should just do it. And this is one thing where I think it's very time sensitive. I'm hopeful that Joe and Kamala decide to go big immediately.
I always find that in politics, there's an allergy to this prioritization conversation, because on some level, of course, you should do everything you can and everything you need. And in my experience, watching the way administrations go, that ends up being a recipe for neglecting long-term problems. So there's always a set of immediate crises right now, more than at most times, but always there's things people can feel in the moment. And the endless problem of climate change is that as much as we can occasionally feel it in the moment, if I walk outside of my door right now, I will breathe in smoke because California is now on fire 3 months of every single year. As much as there are places where people can feel it or can argue that they're feeling it, they don't feel it in the way, and it cannot be as tightly coupled with the pain they have as coronavirus, as losing a job, as losing health insurance. And so we always do the stuff that is right now, the stuff that politicians think they're going to be that will benefit them in the next election because people feel it right now first. And then by the time you've done that and had those vicious battles and exhausted your political capital and made people take hard votes and had the Chamber of Commerce spend $250 million against you, that long-term stuff you wanted to do is just gone. And so I think one of the really hard questions for a Biden administration is going to be whether or not they come in and try to act first on something longer term like climate change at a moment maybe when it does have a short-term power because of the remobilizing job-creating dimension of it, or whether they go to relief and other things like that first. Because if they do that, it always takes longer than you think, and you might end on the other side of it without the political capital to do the other things you want. Like, how do you think about the political strategy of that?
I appreciate what you're saying, Ezra, and I think the emphasis has to be jobs, jobs, jobs. And you can get a lot of stuff done while you're just talking about jobs. You can put cash into people's hands and say, this will be good for local businesses, which it will be. You can hire thousands of people to go to our forest lands and start actually trying to manage the tinderbox that a lot of our forests have become. Because when I looked at the numbers, I think we effectively manage less than 10% of our forest right now because the U.S. Forest Service has not been properly invested in. And so Joe and Kamala can say, you know what we need? Hundreds, even thousands of people in the Forest Service, because we're trying to create jobs. Like, creating jobs can seem universal and nonpartisan in a really effective way. And it is so vital, because if someone's out of the workforce for a while, they then tend to drop out and atrophy. The human impact can result in depression, substance abuse, self-harm, child abuse, like all sorts of just really, really nasty stuff. And everyone knows that Republicans also should get on board with programs if you pitch it as jobs, jobs, jobs. And hopefully you can use the jobs related pitch to try and accomplish things around climate change.
One of the things that has often appealed to people about UBI has, I think, created a false sense that conservatives support UBI, when oftentimes, if you look into those proposals, they collapse the rest of the states that can do UBI, which I think is not generally what you and a lot of progressives support. But something that people like about it and cash transfer in general is that it is a way of getting around the inefficiencies and lack of capacity of the state. And I mean, you see this right now with how much trouble state governments are having doing UI. You see it with the complexity, particularly the rollout of Obamacare, but of Obamacare in general. It is hard to make the federal government work. And doing things where the federal government has to do a lot of complicated things, it's even harder. And there's possibility for corruption and for self-dealing and all the stuff you read about in the papers. And meanwhile, Social Security is a program that works really well. And so there's an appeal to going in that direction. I'm curious, as you were on the trail and as you've thought about this, and somebody coming from a background that was often very concerned with efficiency in the private sector, how you think about that problem, the deep lack of trust Americans often have in the federal government to do hard things, and the more often than I think a lot of progressives would like to admit, times when both state and federal government prove that mistrust had validity. Like, how should a Democratic administration think about and address that fundamental failure and political problem?
This was one of the big elements of my pitch to folks, Ezra, which is I said, look, you know, a lot of people are not that confident in our government's ability to take resources and deliver value to you, to us, in a way that you'll actually feel and be able to utilize every single day. But if it's in the form of cash in your hands, then you'll be able to utilize it in a way that, you know, like benefits you the most, like you can solve your own problems. And there were a lot of folks who were not traditional Dems who were very, very sympathetic to that line of thought, which I happen to believe and agree with. And you talk about healthcare.gov, you know, I was looking into the rollout, which we all remember in 2013.
Ooh, boy, do I remember that rollout.
Yeah, no, it's painful, you know, and like you look at it and it's not exactly inspiring confidence in folks. And you have to take that to heart. Like if you're a Democrat and progressive, which I consider myself, you have to have ambition as to what government can do, but also a sense of reality as to how government can deliver that value to folks. And if the government puts cash into people's hands, it's going to produce so much value and also increased confidence in government among Americans, where you look up and say, well, the government got this right, you know, like this cash certainly helped me a lot. And like, I then turn around and got groceries or got my kid, you know, a tutoring session or whatever the heck it was. And that becomes a very, very powerful glue to help knit us back together instead of just constantly saying, don't worry, this stuff's happening and you should appreciate that it's happening because I'm telling you about it. Instead, you know, it's something that they'll see in their bank account every month. It's just a very, very different experience that I think can actually bring the country together in a powerful way.
My friend Tyler Cowen, who's an economist at Georgia Mason University, has a great podcast called Conversations with Tyler. I think one would describe him as a libertarian-leaning economist, but he's a very idiosyncratic political thinker. Over the past year, he's made this argument for what he calls state capacity libertarianism, which is, I think it's a little bit of a strange idea in that he's arguing that libertarians should or need to move in a direction of worrying more about what the state can deliver than just about how to take the state apart, which I think for obvious reasons, has some issues inside the Libertarian Coalition. But I've been thinking about state capacity progressivism, because I think people assume that like all progressivism is focused on state capacity. And in my experience, it isn't at all. The progressives give very, very little thought to the capacity of the state to accomplish their goals. And this goes from how policymaking happens. It's like everybody knows I am obsessive on the topic of the filibuster, because if you don't do something about that, you can't pass any of the legislation, not literally any, but a lot of the legislation we're talking about is just dead letter. The way the federal government is structured, the way elections happen, but then also within the government itself, how procurement works, how regulatory feedback works. I mean, there's a million things that are really hard and over time have come to work quite badly. And I think that progressives overestimate like how well the government is actually working right now, or at least how well it would work if they controlled it, and that it would be good. I take the point you're making here about a policy feedback cycle where, say, a relief payment creates a sense that the government can actually help you, and so you should trust the government to do more, and maybe you build up the ladder that way. But I also just wish I heard more from Democrats in power about how you're actually going to make the government work, how it's going to be able to absorb technology faster, how you're going to make it so that Congress, when you have power, can actually return and revisit legislation that can work a little bit better, how you're going to make things just move a bit quicker. That we've gotten so trapped in this government good or bad argument that you end up having a lot less focus than I think you need, given the size and complexity of particularly progressive ambitions for government, on how the government works and what do you do when it's not working? How do you fix that? How do you identify it? How do you surface it? I think it has shown in our coronavirus response really poorly.
Ezra, I cannot tell you how much I agree with what you just said. It is so important. Do you have like a name for this school of thought right now? Because we need it really badly. There's just like this entire government good, government bad argument. And instead, what Americans hunger for is smart, effective government. You know, we can see that government has become less effective, certainly at the congressional level, very obviously, but also in other aspects. And no one's having the right conversation around that. So do you have like a name for this concern and a school of thought? Because I am 100% with you and I've been thinking about the exact same thing.
I'll think of naming. I mean, I feel like you should give Tyler Cowen's. I can't believe that the term state capacity libertarianism took off. So maybe state capacity progressivism will too. But I'll just say, as on my soapbox here for a minute, this is why it infuriates me to see Democrats, although this appears to me to be changing a bit now, but be so lackadaisical in the filibuster. Because what you're basically saying there is, as the party that tells people government can work, you don't care that it doesn't. As a party that goes out in elections and promises people all these amazing things you're going to do, you don't care that you're actually going to fail them, or you don't care enough to do anything about it. You are more concerned about esoteric and, at this point, what everybody agrees are unbelievably misused old rules of the Senate than about delivering on all these crises, many of them literally life and death, that you've promised people you'll do something about. And so it just, you know, whatever the name for it, I would think it would actually just be like what being a progressive or a Democrat is about. Like, a precondition to wanting to do all these things through the government is making sure the government can do things in the first place. I mean, I saw this Mark Andreessen piece a while back that got a lot of attention, the venture capitalist, called Why We Can't Build, which is interesting. And I wrote this response to it, which is simply that a lot of why we can't build is that the government and institutions can't operate, right? Like, you need to take an institutional perspective. And I am really struck by how much Democrats, elected Democrats here, do not believe what they say. They do not believe that the problems they are facing are as bad as they say on the stump. And I'm talking here mainly for Senate Democrats, because if they did believe this was all so important,
they would get rid of the filibuster
and do a million other things that would make government work better, procurement reform, all these different things. Like, if you care about things, you figure out how to make it work. If you care about talking about things, then you don't worry about that operational and implementation side so much.
Ezra, this is my new mission in life, which is to try and fix the mechanics of our government so it can actually deliver to us. Because check it out, I ran for president and you know, you keep getting goaded, like you said, into making these very, very grand statements. And then you start reflecting. And I had this reflection, you can say whatever you will about me on it, but I had the reflection where I was like, oh my gosh, like if I get into DC, I need to deliver these things. You know what I mean? Like, what's the point of making these arguments if you're accepting a government that couldn't deliver on them anyway? And so you need to get rid of the filibuster. You need to have the operating system of government get refreshed and updated. You may not agree with this, but I'm for term limits in part for this reason, like the reason you described, where you have this gerontocracy. The average member of Congress is 62, I believe. They don't understand what's happening in most of the country. And the fact is, their incentives are not tied to whether we succeed or fail anymore, because as long as they know they can't get challenged in their district, which a lot of them can't be because it's a safe district and, you know, you've got like a 7-digit cash advantage to start with, then they can actually let us sink further into the mud and keep their jobs. And they know that. And so the government failures that we're talking about. Like, I'm very, very passionate now about trying to actually get in and fix the mechanics so that our government can function. And that's democracy reform. That's legislative changes like you're describing. That's, in my mind, term limits. And I even have a clever way that we can pass term limits. You say, look, everyone, let's pass term limits, but current legislators are exempt. And that way it's no skin off your back. It's going to be the generation after you. But at least this way we can look forward to legislators that actually are just trying to get stuff done and then go home, as opposed to crouching in DC for decades at a time.
I'm not a term limits fan, for reason I've argued on the show, but I'm not gonna get us in that morass. But I think what you're saying in general here is really important. And I just remember watching 2000 Democratic presidential debates, and you lived through them in a much more intense way than I did. And just thinking as people argued over like minute questions of like this Medicare for All plan or that Medicare for Most plan, or you know, like this gun control plan that won't pass or that gun control plan that won't pass, that it was just a fantasy land debate. Because until there was agreement, even just among Democrats, right, who still didn't even have control of the Senate, right, the two questions that mattered, or the three maybe, is like, if a Democrat wins the White House, so the two next questions that matter for a governing agenda is, did Democrats win Congress? And did Senate Democrats do something about the filibuster? And if the answer to either of those questions was no, then virtually everything else that got talked about was gone. Not literally everything else. So some stuff you could do the budget reconciliation in a complicated way that makes legislation a lot worse than it would otherwise be. So it's not a great alternative, but there's some stuff you could do that way. But all the stuff about democracy reform, gun control, like everything that isn't an executive order or a foreign policy decision is gone. And it would get like almost no discussion. And it all just struck me sometimes as a very... I would call it unserious, but it's actually not harsh enough. It was a deceptive way of doing politics.
It seemed like a bizarre theater performance. And this is from someone who is part of it. And I would react to it being like, wow, like these are our lines. Like what's going on? Like what are the stage directions? And so Ezra, I've got a name for this, like the mechanics you're talking about of this movement. It's like the let's get real. You know, like let's stop playing in fantasy land and say like, okay, like what can we actually get done? What are the rules we need to change to get it done? Who do we need? Because so much of our politics is degenerating into value statements. It's one reason why I think I seemed different is because people kept sticking a mic in my face and saying like, make a value statement, make a value statement. And I was, it's like, I'm just trying to solve problems. Like the main problem I want to solve is that people are poor for no reason. And that if we change that, we'd change a lot of other things very positively, including, I believe, our fractured politics, in at least in some measure. But you're like the let's get real stuff. I mean, you're right. Like if you have a filibuster, it doesn't matter if I change a couple seats here and there. Like you know, you're never going to get to a threshold where you can pass the filibuster. There's nothing in the Constitution about a filibuster. It is just some weird, arcane, esoteric Senate rule that took on a life of its own. And so if you're willing to put that rule above getting stuff done, then what are you doing there?
The Ezra Klein Show will return after a quick message from our sponsors.
Support for this show comes from Atlassian. Atlassian software like Jira, Confluence, and Loom help power global collaboration for all teams so they can accomplish everything that's impossible alone. Because individually, we're great, but together, we're so much better. That's why millions of teams around the world, including 75% of the Fortune 500, trust Atlassian software for everything from space exploration and green energy to delivering pizzas and podcasts. Whether you're a team of 2, 200, or 2 million, or whether your team is around the corner or on another continent altogether, Atlassian software is built to help keep you all on the same page from start to finish. That way, every one of your teams, from engineering and IT to marketing, HR and legal, can stay connected and move together as one towards shared company-wide goals. Learn how to unleash the potential of your team at Atlassian.com. That's Atlassian.com. Atlassian.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.
I want to talk about something else you brought to the debates. It was always my favorite part of the Andrew Yang subplot of Democratic debates, which was, and we've touched on this already, trying to inject questions of technology into them. You often would do this when it came to climate change, talking about things like fourth generation nuclear, and it happened pretty often. And something I've been reflecting on another track has been that a lot of the problems that I care most about solving, they have a huge technological dimension to them. I care a lot about animal suffering, and by far the most promising way to do something about that is plant and cell-based meat. I care a lot about climate change, and while I've had Saul Griffith on the show talking about how we could fix climate change without any new technology being invented, there's just no doubt that given the level of mandate and adoption and take-up that we'll need, if we can invent some great new stuff, it would become a lot easier. AI often gets talked about in a dystopic way, but if we really could invent it, it could make life pretty amazing. I'm a big healthcare wonk. I've spent a lot of my career on health insurance policy. But what the reason we care about health insurance is it can make you healthier. And what will make you healthier to some degree is technological advances in things like how we fight cancer and, you know, handle gene therapies and other things. And one of the things that has struck me is that I don't think progressives in general have much of a theory of technology anymore. I think that it's often talked about in this dystopic way. There's a lot of frustration at the billionaires who own it. I often felt you sort of like oscillated between like a very scary story about AI and then also like a real interest in technology as a way of solving problems. And I'd love to just hear you reflect on that. Like what do you think the political orientation to technology in general should be?
I love where you are on this, Ezra. Like I think that ideally, progressives are for progress. and you know what is going to enable a ton of progress is technology. And one of the fun things about my campaign was I was making some very dark arguments about the impact of technology, which I completely believe. If you have autonomous trucks in the next, you know, I'll extend the timeline because I know you and I differ on this, but like let's say like 20 years, you know, like there'll be millions of folks who used to drive a truck for a living who, you know, will need something else to do. So I believe all of that wholeheartedly. But I also agree with you that if you're trying to make people smarter, healthier, mentally healthier, trying to clean up our planet, trying to feed people in a way that doesn't brutalize animals, technology is a part of every single one of those solutions in a very central way. And one of the dangers to me about a lot of our politics now is we're each arguing for different brands of nostalgia. You know what I mean? You know, meanwhile, time only goes in one direction. You know, it's 2020. You're now out in California. Like I spent a lot of time there. And you go to some of the folks who are working on the future, and it is wild. Like some of the things that they're working on are very positive and inspirational. Some of them are very depressing and dystopian. But they're all packaged together, and we should not be a group of people or a party that also has our heads in the sand about the positive and negative changes that technology brings. Like we have to be the party that is hard-nosed and realistic, but also willing to embrace the technologies that could lead us to something that more closely resembles utopia than this current mess we're living. So I love what you just said, Ezra. Like, you know, I completely agree. Like, we need to be embracing these technologies at a much higher level. And I may be a part of that in this next administration if we succeed in getting Trump out of there.
Wait, I want to follow up on that tantalizing, I may be a part of that. Is there a job you've been talking about?
Oh, so I've had just very, very general informal conversations with the Biden camp about trying to take on some sort of technology-facing role. Both some of the concerns that I campaigned on and trying to address them. And one thing we haven't talked about, but I'm very passionate about that you will be too in a few years, is the effect of social media and technology on our kids' mental health. Right now you have massive levels of anxiety and depression among teenage girls in particular in order to make certain companies like Facebook richer. which, you know, is not a good look. But our government is way behind the curve on these issues, and I've offered my help in trying to catch us up, and there's some interest in taking me up on that.
And so then to go back to this underlying question, you said something I thought that's worth picking up on about you talk to people in Silicon Valley and you go look at what they're doing, and some of it is very utopian and some of it is very dystopian. And I've had probably some of the same conversations with even some of the same people you have. And what always strikes me is that it's not, in most cases, intrinsic to the technology which way that plays out. And oftentimes, it is actually about the way the government and both the rules of markets and regulations, but also to some degree, government implementation, taxation, et cetera, is going to interface with the technology that's going to decide whether it ends up being like utopian or dystopian. And so there sometimes seems to me to be a more obvious approach here, which is that I would say that it should be a more central priority, frankly, for both parties, to use the government as a research and innovation accelerant. But then it also has to be a more central priority, again, hopefully for both parties, for the government to have views and to care about how the technology is rolled out, who has access to it, and also what rules it operates under. AI is the most obvious example of this, just given the size of its potential impact. But there's a broad set of problems right now where, you know, we could put a lot of money into, say, drug development, which we already do, and then insist on very different rules for, say, how patents work and how quickly things move to generic. Bernie Sanders, I've always said this, one of my favorite healthcare policies of his going way back in his Senate career is this idea to create prizes and not patents, or at least a parallel track where we would create, you know, prizes, say $5 billion if you can create a drug that does this thing. And then if you do it, you get the $5 billion and the drug is generic from the minute it goes forward. And so just like a much higher level of sophistication with both how to accelerate the advance of technology, but then also how to make sure its benefits are more broadly shared and its risks are attended to than we currently have, would seem wise to me.
Yeah, that it's spot on, Ezra. And right now, our government is out to lunch on most of these technology issues, and we need to change it. You know, and I agree with you, this should be central for both parties because the rate of change is just getting faster and faster. We got rid of the Office of Technology Assessment in 1995, 25 years ago. And we can all sense that.
Well, there was no more technology.
Oh, yeah. No, we invented everything. 95.
That ended in 95.
Yeah. It's embarrassing, really. And we can all sense it. Like, everyone just has this collective groan when it comes to government and technology. And then again, you have something like healthcare.gov where you're like, oh, no, like they tried to make a website. You know, like, I mean, I shouldn't laugh because it was freaking terrible.
Let me go in on the healthcare.gov thing for one second, because I did a lot of reporting on that. And something that breaks my heart about what has happened since then. So I did a ton. I wrote a Business Week cover on this. And like the federal government's procurement rules, what was encoded into the legislation, and then just some of the ways the agencies work together, who they could hire, when they could hire, et cetera. It was all just built for disaster. And the Obama administration people just didn't, like very few people saw this coming clearly, or they would have done something to stop it. But in the aftermath of that unbelievable catastrophe, they actually did a lot of really good things. They created this group 18F. They brought in a lot more software development talent and began using, and at least I don't think they ever got where they needed to go or anywhere near it on changing procurement, particularly procurement rules around software, which like you would never do procurement for software in like the private industry, the way the federal government.
It was like 1,800 pages of procurement rules.
It's wild. And then it also meant that the people who understood how to navigate the procurement process were not the best software developers. They were these massive consultancies that had built, that had like invested a lot in lawyers to navigate the procurement process. So anyway, there was a lot that was happening on that. I would say the Obama administration in the aftermath of that catastrophe, which was on their lap, did a lot of really good things in terms of beginning to put CTOs in the agencies and so on. Procurement did not go through Congress in the way I was hoping it would. And then it just got destroyed under Trump. I mean, whatever progress was being made and needed to be consolidated, like the world of 18F and things, like I still follow it somewhat, and it's been really bad. And I think that's one thing that is a little bit under like underrated as one of the disasters of his era. Like whatever modernization was happening in government just stopped. And we needed a lot more than was happening. But it's really a shame that we lost so much of the progress that had begun.
I couldn't agree more. And that's something that we should try and rev up and invest in meaningfully. I looked into it too. The US Digital Service, which did come about in the aftermath of healthcare.gov, it's still operating, but it's down to something like 180 people. And if you look at the scope of the federal workforce, I mean, that's not enough to tell it there.
And it's not empowered, right? Those people are not empowered.
Yeah. So they're often on short-term stints, but even within their constraints, they're projected to save something like $600 million in government costs, and in part because of the procurement process you talked about. So I'm with you that healthcare.gov ended up leading to some real modernization efforts that have now stalled under Trump that hopefully we can get back to.
So if you were helping to modernize government on technology in a future administration, how would you think about that? Where would you start? What would be the kinds of things you would imagine doing?
You would ramp up the United States Digital Service and empower it, to your point. And you and I both know that there are hundreds, maybe even thousands of very talented technologists, designers, coders who would help government if they had a runway to do so and felt like they could actually be empowered as opposed to going and just sitting in meetings and getting their hands tied in red tape and bureaucracy and the rest of it. So instead of 180, you should have something like 10 to 20 times that number of folks working to help implement some of the policies that folks are envisioning for us digitally. So that would be step one. You take what's been working and then you pour fuel on it. The other thing I would be trying to do is, I think that there should be some kind of West Coast base of operation, in part as a talent enlistment move, because there are a lot of techies that might not want to uproot their families and head to DC. And so you need to give them a place to reside and land. And then we need to have actual experts get into the guts of the social media companies and the apps, because each of these companies is its own thing. Like you can't really have one size fits all, for example, 20th century antitrust rules when it comes to, you know, Facebook and Instagram and the rest of it. Though I do think that they should not have allowed them to acquire Instagram. But that there are all of these features that are company specific that you need real expertise to try and get to the bottom of and see if you can curb the worst of the excesses.
A lot of this conversation is operated in the implicit hypothetical that Joe Biden wins, because if he doesn't, most of the things we're talking about are not going to happen. But imagining the alternative path, what do you think a second Trump term would look like?
It would be catastrophic, in my opinion, because we're seeing the deterioration and disintegration of our way of life. And I don't see that reversing itself under Trump. I think with Joe and Kamala, it still will not reverse itself as if by magic, but there's at least a chance that we'll get enough of a consensus to invest trillions of dollars in jobs, infrastructure, economic relief, healthcare, climate change mitigation, you name it. Like there's at least a chance. I mean, we have a multi-trillion dollar hole that's been blasted in our annual economy, and tens of millions of us have gotten pushed to the side. And I said this in my DNC speech that, you know, we have to give ourselves a chance, and we at least get a fighting chance with Joe and Kamala. So hopefully they're our next president and vice president.
You made a point during the Zoom call of former presidential candidates that I thought was really sharp about the ways in which Biden has this magical power, you said, to when he endorses something, it becomes mainstream, it becomes normalized. Do you want to talk a little bit about what you meant by that?
Yes. The magic of Joe Biden is anything he gets behind becomes the new reasonable. And I really saw this when he proposed this $2 trillion climate change plan, that if it had come out of Bernie's mouth, people would have seen as extreme. But because it was Joe, it was like, oh yeah, totally, that's the thing to do. And I also want to give credit to David Axelrod, who said something similar to me that I then ended up parroting in that Zoom roundtable. But Joe's magic is that he has the potential to be a transformative figure in terms of policy without ever actually coming across as transformative. It's a real gift he has.
I want to ask you one more thing about a Trump second term. During the campaign, you talked a fair amount about Asian American discrimination. You wrote a Washington Post piece about feeling after the coronavirus that people were staring at you with suspicion in a way that hadn't been true before. There have been arguments about your approach to this in different ways. But when you listen to Trump during his convention speech, calling it the China virus and saying that, you know, reelect him and he'll make sure to make China pay, like, how did that strike you personally? How did you see that playing out?
No, I felt like it was Trump reverting to his usual playbook of distracting from his own failures by calling attention to, in this case, what he was characterizing as the Kung flu and the China virus and the rest of it. Certainly as an Asian American, it's painful because there's always a sense that somehow your Americanness is in question, and having Trump double down on that is really corrosive for the country, but it's painful for Asian Americans in particular. And I do feel like our Americanness has been questioned to a higher degree in the wake of the coronavirus than has been the case at really any point in my memory.
The thing that I was reflecting on after it was when I started in politics as a journalist, sort of in the early 2000s, there was pre-9/11, but then very much post-9/11, this hunger for an enemy. And, you know, people talked about the clash of civilizations between, you know, the West and Islam. And there was this real desire, particularly among, I think, politicians who are comfortable in a Cold War consensus and a Cold War framework, to find the new external threat. And I'm not a big fan of what China, the way China withheld information on the coronavirus. And I'm certainly not a fan of their movement towards authoritarianism, what they are doing to the Uyghurs. You can listen to past episodes of the show on this. But I'm really pretty scared of, and I think it would be very prominent in a second Trump term, this idea that you want to create an oppositional relationship between America and China in particular, but arguably Asia more generally, that politicians who see their own political safety in creating an enemy and creating fear in a world where we have to actually work together on threats like coronavirus, future pandemics, things like that, it's such the wrong lesson to me. And it's such a potentially dangerous thing that I feel like people don't actually talk about it that much, because I think properly one's feelings towards China right now should be somewhat complicated, at least on a policy level, not towards people there. But nevertheless, very little would be as bad as America. And if people have not really lived through this in Washington, I don't think you realize how quickly it can happen. As a clash of civilizations narrative becoming the dominant foreign policy framework, now not towards the Middle East, because that didn't turn out to be what they needed it to be to keep driving American politics for decades and decades, but now towards China.
I agree with you on all fronts, Ezra. You and I agree on a lot of things. Who knew?
There's too much agreement in this conversation. It's a disaster.
No. We'll think of something to disagree on momentarily. But a few things. Number one is, we all know that there's a military-industrial complex that likes to keep us engaged, shall we say, in a way to spend the $700 billion. A friend of mine who's an engineer at one of the big aerospace companies at the end of the Cold War said that they actually came together in a room or all right, who's the next war going to be with? It's very dark. Those are the kinds of things you hear from folks who are attached to the industry. And I agree with you that Trump's playbook is to find an enemy. And in this case, it's going to naturally head towards China and the East to disastrous consequences. And the goal should be to, and I agree, it's a very, very complex, fraught relationship with some massive, massive problems and concerns around the things you described, and then some. Their theft of our intellectual property, massive, massive problem. But you need to have some kind of relationship with China in order to guard against the next pandemic, to make progress on climate change, to make progress on data and AI concerns, to make progress on North Korea. There is a much less safe world if you aren't in touch with the Chinese government to the point where you even can speak to them about something that's happening that would concern American well-being. So that's a reality. And unfortunately, we are getting to a point now where where folks feel better served politically by trying to present like a different version of reality for purposes that, you know, may benefit them, their party, certain economic interests, but are really bad for all of us long term. And to your point too, as someone who grew up in this country, you know, one of like the simmering fears you have as an Asian American is that like if you wind up with like a US-China geopolitical conflict, that like Asian Americans will end up being caught right in the middle.
Let me ask you one more question that's political before we wrap up. We'll have to wait for more disagreement for the next podcast, which is, as somebody who's a newcomer to the institutional Democratic Party, I think you've probably voted Democrat before, but being involved in it as a political actor, I think, is newer to you, and came in from the outside of it. What is one mistake you wish Democrats would stop making, a habit or idea that you would advise them to drop? Like, what is one way you'd like to change the Democratic Party?
Wow, Ezra, I like this question. And, you know, it's been a real learning journey for me. I said this in another context, but I think Democrats need to figure out why it is that many working class Americans do not feel like we are fighting for them or we stand for them. And I ran into this all the time on the trail, like a waitress or a truck driver or a retail clerk. When they found out I was a Democrat, like it's like I had said a dirty word. And I thought to myself, well, how is this? Like, you know, you're a trucker, waitress, clerk. Like, shouldn't you be who we are fighting for? Like, shouldn't everything I'm talking about actually be appealing to you? And I think we've gotten caught in these exchanges that don't actually feel like they're relevant to those folks. And we need to get better at it. You know, I think, unfortunately, Republicans have become more effective at communicating to certain groups of people than we have. And instead of saying, well, it's their fault, like we should do some soul searching and be like, why is it that they don't think that we're speaking to them? And one of the things I said in another environment was that, like, we do not want to be characterized as the party of the educated elite or folks who just live in big cities. Because if that's the case, then trying to reach folks that we're going to need to reach around the country is going to be very, very difficult. So that would be one big message I'd have. And I'm obviously like on board with a lot of the policy prescriptions that we have. I just want to try and present them to folks in a way that makes it feel like it's going to touch them and improve their lives every single day. And it doesn't seem as top down, it's more bottom up. And this goes back to your earlier point before about good, good government, not so good government. It's like we can't get trapped in these abstractions. We have to try and translate it into the concrete and the direct. And that includes getting to a point where we can be realistic about how to deliver value to people.
That's where we'll leave it. So now the final question is always, what are three books you've read that you would recommend to the audience?
So a few books I've read recently that I enjoyed and got a lot out of. The first is Humankind by Rutger Bregman. Annie's probably read this one. Rutger is one of the universal basic income.
Not just to Annie. Rutger was on the show a couple months ago now. What is time? But yeah, it's a good book.
Yeah, good stuff. So the great thing about Humankind is it makes you question human nature itself. Like, are we as bad as a lot of, folks would have us believe? Maybe not. So that book was edifying and enlightening. I really enjoyed Zucked by Roger McNamee. So if you care about what's going on with Facebook, it's a really easy to read narrative about one investor's skepticism towards Facebook that grew into more than skepticism. It actually started from non-skepticism to skepticism to fear and activism. And so if you're concerned about Facebook, Zucked is a good book to read. And then the third thing I'd recommend, which is probably near and dear to your heart, Ezra, is They Do Not Represent Us by Lawrence Lessig. And it's about democracy reform and how our representative government may not be that representative. And he started with problems around campaign finance reform, which are fundamental. But then he goes into various structural reforms around the need for ranked choice voting and other things. And I am a huge fan of Lawrence's argument. It's something that I believe we need to be paying more attention to.
Andrew Yang, thank you very much.
Thanks, Ezra. Always a pleasure. Appreciate you.
Thank you to Andrew Yang for being here. Thank you to all of you for being here. To Roger Karma for researching, Jeffrey Geld for producing. The Ezra Klein Show is a Vox Media podcast production.
Startups, you don't need to settle for a cumbersome banking experience to protect your money. Mercury offers banking and credit cards with effortless experience, giving ambitious companies greater precision, control, and focus without compromising security. Open smarter checking and savings accounts, control spend, optimize cash flow, and close the books in record time. Visit Mercury.com to join more than 100,000 startups that trust Mercury with their finances and to help them perform at their highest level.